and I wanted to give you a slight preview about the Dempster Highway episode. What you will hear is that story, obviously my central theme that I saw in 1997, the wolves crossing the Dempster Highway. I think it was somewhere near, I can't remember, Eagle Plains, I think. I have to look up my notes. But I remember seeing wolves crossing the Dempster Highway. That's one thing you'll hear, the story there. I will kind of walk you through woodland and barren ground caribou. I will talk about Ahama, which is in Finnish, called wolverines, very little though. And there will be a book we will talk about, Wolves of the Yukon, which will be a central running theme. I was very, very grateful when the author gave me permission to use his book. He's like, don't worry, you can go ahead and use it. And I'm happy if it helps your project. And I was like, oh, thank you, Bob Hayes. So thank you, Bob Hayes. I will be using his book, Wolves of the Yukon, in many different ways. I might read certain chapters to you to explain the context, right? Or why this, that, when at this time.
Imagine a place in North America that has hardly changed in thousands of years. 500,000 square kilometers of unbroken, rugged mountains, interrupted here and there by forested valleys and seldom traveled highways, linking a handful of small villages. A land where more people lived 100 years ago than do today. Where moose and caribou still outnumber people 10 to 1. Where there is a wolf for every 5 humans. The Yukon is a vast mountain wilderness. It occupies the northwest corner of the Great Western Cordillera, a long chain of high mountain ridges that stretch the length of North and South America. It is hard to stand anywhere in the Yukon and not see a mountain. There are dozens of ranges, the Barne and British Mountains in the far north, the Ruby Range and St. Elias Mountains to the west, the Coast and Cassia Mountain to the south, and the great backbone of the Selwyn Mountains, forming the east boundary of the territory. In between, there are many more mountain ranges, big and small. To the casual eye, the mountains are rock and snow, an impossible place for animals to live. But if we look closer, we find even the highest plateaus, ridges and slopes support vegetation. There is plant life and animal food is everywhere on the mountain. And a handful of Yukon herbivores have found ways to thrive in the mountain world. Moose, caribou and Dall's sheep migrate up and down the slopes in search of seasonal food, cover, insect relief, escape to rain, water, breeding and birthing areas, and other features they need to survive. The mountain supports diverse mammal life, and wolves have learned how to hunt it. There are 5,000 wolves in the Yukon, and they live virtually everywhere. They roam the Yukon North Slope following caribou. They cross the highest glaciers of Kluane, hunting Dall's sheep and mountain goat, and they work the forested river plateaus, preying on moose. The Yukon wolf is a mountain wolf. I can't think of a wolf pack home range that does not include a mountain range. Although the mountains seem impassable to us, the rugged mountain terrain actually makes travel easy for the wolves. Using wind-blown ridges and slopes, wolves can move quickly across their territories in all seasons, even in the deepest part of the winter. Yukon wolves have learned where, when, and how to hunt and kill mountain prey. Part 2. Understanding. Chapter Title, Cordillera. In the book, Wolves of the Yukon by Bob Hayes.
Welcome to Sartastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This podcast is dedicated to Fraser Mendonca, who left Denver and Leti in September 2023 before their October road trip to Northern BC and the Yukon.
Scene 6. 9th of March, 2024. Phrased in school at Sodankula, Lappi.
Professor Scamander, do you have a moment?
Yes, Hannah, hi. What is this about?
It's rather odd, because I spoke with Aranya last week, and she's still at the location, but she mentioned that she was reading a letter from Arthur St. Cyr, a letter from 1899. She found that particular letter in the notes that she received from Neville. I'm a little confused, because she was quite sure that you had nothing to do with it, and she kept emphasizing that you didn't know anything, and then she happened to tell you this the last time you met, that Neville gave her Professor Long's notes, and those notes included this letter. Is there a reason why you chose to not inform her? Aranya seemed clueless about it. What are we trying to hide from her again?
It's not that we're trying to hide it from her, but I think she might find something on her own that we might have overlooked. And that could help us, because if she happens to find something that we overlooked, we could get a clue about the Elder Wand, because you know we still are struggling with it. I've perused through tomes of literature and conversations between Professor Long and Ogilvy, and I also went through the Yukon maps that Ogilvy had shared with Professor Long. I think he had collaborated with Arthur St. Cyr in updating those Yukon maps when Arthur St. Cyr was surveying these parts of the Yukon. I didn't want to tell her about the connection at this point because I think it would just lead her in another direction and she might suspect that we are hiding something. So I want her to kind of figure this out independently and see where that leads us. I think the last time I spoke with her was 2 days ago. She was around, I can't remember, she mentioned some peak. She was along the wrong path though, I think. She was around Mud Peak, somewhere close to the origin of the Liard. When we looked up the map, she said she was around Mud Peak, and she wasn't sure that there is a tributary, which she thinks might be a tributary of the Liard, and she was under the assumption that it had something to do with the connection to Pelly River, or it probably has something to do with McNeil River. I still want her to stay around the Quiet Lake, so I asked her to reconsider that decision to go down Moss Lake and McNeil River. That's where we closed off the conversation. I sense that you don't agree. What's bothering you, Hannah?
I'm uncomfortable with this approach, Professor Scamander. Why are we asking Aranya to find something that we need to find? Like, why are we sending her to all these places? She was commissioned just to write the textbook. And yes, I agree with you that Aranya is probably the best person for this job because she's written a textbook on Thestrals. And she is studying the paleo habitat of the Thestrals, so I'm sure she'll find something that we have overlooked. But it just seems a little risky to me.
Hang on, Hannah. I don't think it's risky at all. We have a lot of folks looking after her. From a distance, I agree. And she definitely likes the landscape. I don't see any harm in her involving her. I'll probably inform her after she's back from the Yukon. But that could take a while, because she's looking at a lot of places. I'm just relieved that I changed her mind with respect to the McNeil River, because she was going down the Liard and trying to figure out the Pelly connection there. Ogilvy has covered that area. I don't think we have anything to be worried about. She'll be fine. And I assure you, if something does get risky, we'll pull her out of there. We should leave it at that for now and see what Aranya finds.
This episode is the first of a few that will include a book by Bob Hayes titled Wolves of the Yukon. As you know, Aranya is already somewhere around Quiet Lake along Colonel Road, and she has been conducting some research about the Yukon Tanana terrain and the Quiet Lake batholith and the area around Porcupine Peak, Quetzal Peak. Generally, that's the landscape she's looking at currently. The reason we have this book right at the start of the episode is because this was supposed to be the book that was to be featured in Letty's first podcast called Arctic House, which is now indefinitely on hold because of Fraser's passing. But that podcast was dedicated to two main regions. Season one was just a backstory, a couple of episodes that included Letty's backstory about the Yukon to set the stage. The second season was all about Snow Change Cooperative, an organization that is behind the rewilding effort in Finland. And initially, this is way back, and not way back, just 2 years ago, in 2022, Letty was following an organization called Lumi Muutos Osuus Kunta. That's Snow Change Cooperative in Finnish. And she was supposed to follow this organization for more than 4 days, but she ended up following them only for 4 days. The initial plan, this was in May, I think, last week of May, early June, was to follow this organization for 4 days just to look at the gamut of things they are involved in and then collaborate with them for longer than 4 days. Follow them, talk about their story, document it, interview a couple of people, and just a lot of things that document the whole rewilding Finland effort in season two. And then season three was to be all about Letty's first love, the Yukon. Second, actually, after her dogs. But obviously, the Yukon came before her dogs. So at that time, it was Letty's first love. Since around 95, 96. 97 is when she always talks about. But it is linked to the wolves along the Dempster Highway. That is 96, 97. And also to the wolves being introduced to the Yellowstone National Park. And these were wolves from Canada. Initially, Letty thought they were from the Yukon, but they were wolves from Alberta. The impression that she had was that Yukon was this beautiful place that had all these lovely wolves. And there is this episode where she talks about the Richardson Mountain. That's something we won't get into in this episode. And you will hear Letty talk about it. Actually, you'll hear Aranya talk about it. The Richardson and its context comes up there, I think around 15 minutes or something into the episode. I don't know where this fun fits it, so it could be longer. When she starts the first segment about the letter, after the first segment, which is for around 12 or 14 minutes of the first segment, then she starts talking about the Richardson. Anyways, but that will be a separate season altogether. So season three of Arctic House, which was her first podcast, was supposed to be after completing her backstory and after completing the Rewilding Finland season, the third season, and then the following seasons from there would be all about the Yukon and Northern Canada and Arctic Canada. This was planned in 2022 when Letty had no clue that she would actually be coming to Canada. So she kept the flame alive for almost 27 years now. It's in April, we'll be completing 27 years. So she kept the flame alive as a kid that maybe someday life will bring her to the Yukon. Now that dream is coming to fruition because she's not even 1,000 kilometers. I think it's 970 kilometers from the border. It's around 600. She's around 600 kilometers from the border of the Yukon. There'll be a short trip and then Letty will be redirecting to another place before she comes back to the Yukon for good, hopefully. But that's definitely the ultimate. The last stop is definitely the Yukon. It was the first stop and it was the destination, but circumstances have still not got her exactly to where she needs to get to. So she's still close to the Yukon, probably visiting the Yukon. I'm not sure till that happens. We can say still probably because she's still about less than a thousand kilometers away from it, but she still hasn't been there. So you still can't say that she's there. That was what Arctic House was all supposed to be all about. And the book would come up in a big way because when you listen to the Yukon connection, when you listen to a few episodes of that, I mean, there are hardly a few left now because initially she had a lot of episodes, but then she took them down. Later, she edited some and put them back again. So now there are just about 7 episodes, including Fraser's farewell, his goodbye, and his enfolding episode, which is where she paused the podcast indefinitely. But the book, Wolves of the Yukon, was supposed to come out in that podcast. Little did she know in 2022 that she was coming to Canada. At least when she started the podcast in late Feb, early March, she plucked up the courage to say, okay, fine, I will put out my podcast. She started Arctic House. That was the commencement. At that time, she didn't know it, but by May, June, she was already aware that she's coming to Canada, and which is why the whole Rewilding Finland season got derailed because she moved to Canada in 2022. And then she was like, if the source is where she's going to, then maybe she should just for now pause the second season and come to the source because that's where she was supposed to go to. The reason I wanted to bring this up in this episode is because from this episode onward, you will start to see certain things that are part of the plot, but they're also part of the earlier podcast. And so this episode starts with the prelude of the book. Then you have the conversation between Professor Scamander and Professor Abbott. And Abbott is concerned, why is Professor Scamander not telling Aranya that he was the one who gave Long's package to Neville Longbottom? So there's that piece there. And then Aranya, as she's still at that location around Quiet Lake Batholith, she happens to go through Professor Long's package and then she finds this letter, which is about a survey east of Teslin Lake. So Arthur Saint Seer, who also updates the Yukon map, and that's the connection to Ogilvy, who obviously you know is connected to Professor Long, who is the founder of the Mary Pelle House. That's how the threads connect. And then she's reading this letter, which is quite a long letter. So that's why this episode runs long. But she has skipped certain parts in the letter. And initially I thought of chopping off a lot of it because the episode was running long. But then when I started reading the letter and looking at the map, you kind of let that letter's content flow. And then you're just looking at the map through the letter, through the eyes of Arthur Saint in 1897-98. I decided to leave the letter as is. Although I didn't read the whole letter, I did skip a lot of paragraphs, but I covered all the sections in the letter. And I will leave you with that because that's just a context that I needed to give on why we are looking at this letter. Appendix number 20 to the report of the Surveyor General. Report of Arthur Saint, Dominion Land Surveyor. Exploration of the country east of Teslin Lake. Ottawa, May 1st, 1899. Sir, I have the honor to submit my report on the exploration of the district allotted to me in your instructions dated April 13th, 1898. The district to be explored embraced that section of country which extends from Teslin Lake to Pelly River. Your instructions also suggested that if time permitted, I should endeavor to reach Pelly River and ascend Ross River, which is believed to be the principal tributary of the Pelly River from the north. At the same time, I was to make an examination of the country drained by it. I, however, found the water so low in all the streams leading up to the divide between Nazetland River and Pelly River basins that I had to abandon my canoes long before I could reach their sources. Under the circumstances, the only thing left for us was to pack our supplies and outfit, in which case we could not take a sufficient quantity to successfully carry out the exploration. The mountainous character of the country to be examined and the lateness of the season, taken into consideration with the limited help at my disposal, rendered our chances of safely returning from the trip very problematic. After giving due consideration to these difficulties, I decided to limit myself to the exploration of
Nazetlin
and Big Salmon Rivers. The former is the chief feeder of Lake Teslin, and the latter an eastern tributary of the Lewis River. The object of the exploration was to obtain a general knowledge of the district, its topography, and its resources. In order to successfully complete the work during the short summer season, it was decided to connect by triangulation a number of the highest and most prominent points and then fill in the gaps by means of photographs and sketches. The general character of the country is mountainous, and especially so along the upper reaches of
Nazetlin
and Big Salmon Rivers, which of course is very advantageous for photographic surveying. The ascent of 20 peaks was made, which ranged in altitude from 6,000 to 7,000 feet above the level of the sea. Whenever these were located too far apart to furnish the detailed topography of the country, I established intermediate camera stations. 100 photographs were taken from these points for use at some future time in mapping the chief features of this district. To successfully carry on photographic surveys, it is necessary that the atmosphere should be free from smoke, a condition seldom obtained in a country where there are so many prospectors. Therefore, the moment the smoke made its appearance, this work had to be discontinued and other methods substituted, such as instrumental traverses of the navigable rivers and track surveys of the paths following the most important of the mountain streams. I managed in every instance to connect these partial surveys with my triangulation. In a mountainous country, the magnetic needle is not solely to be relied upon. I therefore took solar observations for azimuth from the tops of almost every peak occupied, and thus obtained the astronomical bearings of the other peaks used as triangulation stations, and in this way did not depend altogether on the compass. The observations were the means of detecting considerable abnormal deviations of the needle in certain localities. For instance, in the vicinity of the headwaters of the Rose River, the deviation is to the east of the meridian and amounts to 60 degrees. Similar observations carried on in connection with the traverse of the streams failed to show any abnormal deviation of the needle in the valleys, thus tending to prove that these extraordinary deviations are a feature peculiar to the high peaks which form the crest of the mountain ranges. The instruments furnished were a 3-inch transit theodolite and a surveying camera. I was also given an improved surveying aneroid made by Kufel and Esser. This was a new instrument, and it proved to be a reliable one, a very uncommon thing for an aneroid. The recommendation made in the instructions that I should observe frequently for latitude was adhered to during the whole season. It had been arranged that I should go by way of Skagway and the White Pass to the district in which I was to spend the summer, but at the last moment my route was changed and I went by the way of Stikina River. This change fortunately gave me the opportunity to complete some work which had been left unfinished in the autumn of the previous year. On May 20th, I took passage on the Canadian Pacific Railway Company's steamer Athenian, which sailed from Vancouver, and on the 23rd landed me in Wrangell, which is the place of departure of all steamers navigating the Stikina. A day later, the stern wheel steamer Ogilvy, one of the swiftest boats on the river, left Wrangell and arrived at Glenora on the 26th of May. We saw several large parties of prospectors camped at different points along the river who were on their way to the Yukon goldfields. They started on their journey the previous winter and had hoped to be able to utilize the ice on the Stikina to reach Glenora before the spring thaw. But as the winter had been unusually mild, the ice had not formed over the canyons, and before they could get their outfits around the open water spaces, a general breaking up of the ice had occurred, and they were obliged to seek safety for themselves and outfits on the higher banks of the river. At the time we passed, they were anxiously waiting a chance to be taken on board of a passing steamer. Glenora, which was 6 months before composed of a few old, dilapidated log houses surrounded by some small cultivated patches of land, now presented a lively appearance. Hotels, stores, and large warehouses have been erected in that short space of time along the street facing the river. Back of the business part of the town, miners had pitched their tents, and these covered the ground as far as the foot of a high cliff which limits the town site towards the west. This portion is low and some parts are liable to be flooded in the spring. Better ground is to be found towards the south of the town. This had been judiciously chosen and was at the time occupied by the Yukon military force under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Evans. The tents were pitched on the top of a bench, which is several feet above the river and dotted here and there with poplar bluffs. A cool breeze constantly blowing across the terrace had the good effect of tempering at midday the scorching rays of the sun. All this coupled with fine springs of cold water spouting from the face of a hill close by rendered the spot an ideal one for a military camp. That's my dog Denver drinking, if you can hear something in the background. On my arrival in Glenora, I was informed by some returning packers that the trail to Teslin Lake was in a very bad condition, and for that reason, the pack animals could not carry a heavier load than 150 pounds each. In my outfit, which included three Acme folding boats, I had also some packages of stationery addressed to Gold Commissioner Fawcett. I therefore made arrangements to have these carried by a packed train which was advertised to start at once for the lake. I then left with the rest of my outfit for Teslin Lake, where I arrived on July 16th, having been 26 days covering the distance. The report as to the bad condition of some parts of the trail had not been exaggerated, but on the other hand, improvements in the shape of good substantial bridges over the largest streams such as the Tahalton and Nahalin rivers compensated to a certain extent for the slow traveling over the bad sections of the trail. On the trip to Teslin Lake, I was able, with the instruments I had with me and the favorable weather, to determine the latitude of the following points: Egnell Post, the Nahalin River where it is crossed by the trail, the eastern outlet of Desela Lake, and the mouth of White Swan River. The latitude of the southern extremity of Teslin Lake was also determined. I had not been able to obtain this on a previous trip because of unfavorable weather and pressure of time due to the lateness of the season. I could not help noticing on my arrival at the lake the changes which a dry spring season had made on its surroundings. At the mouth of the White Swan River, which enters the lake at its southern extremity, are alluvial flats where a great quantity of wild hay grows. At a much later date in the previous year, these were covered with water and inaccessible for horses. The meadows were not only dry, but the deep channel of the river which separates them from the mainland was perfectly dry. As a consequence of the drought, the level of the lake was considerably lower. When traveling on the trail to the lake, we passed droves of sheep and cattle which were being taken to the Yukon. This, I believe, is the first time that the trail has been utilized for this purpose. On July 5th, a drove of 40 head of cattle, which had been brought from the United States as a speculative venture, was met in the vicinity of Hutton Lake, 65 miles distant from the Teslin Lake. They had therefore at the time covered more than half of the distance between Glenora and the lake. The drovers informed me that they had experienced no difficulty in finding an abundance of good feed in close proximity to the trail. Their intention after reaching the lake was to take the cattle on rafts to Dawson, where they expected to obtain a good price for them. I was informed later on that they had succeeded beyond their expectations and that another party had, by the same means, taken several hundred sheep down the river. The moment I reached the lake, preparations were commenced for the exploration.
Nazetland River
had been reported to me as being so swift over the greatest part of its course that poling would have to be resorted to in order to ascend it if any kind of progress was to be made against its current. To counteract the great strain to which the boats would be subjected and to give them the additional strength necessary for the better performance of the special work which would be required of them in poling or tracking against strong currents, two extra pieces of wood a little longer than the boat, 3 inches wide in the middle and tapering to 1.5 inches at the ends, were added to each side of the boat. These pieces were placed longitudinally outside the boats and pressed tightly against them when fastened at their extremities. Both pieces were well fastened together, but the end, which carried the tow line, was depressed to the indicated waterline when the boat was loaded to its full capacity. The reason for tying the line low is that in coming to a ripple or in trying to avoid dangerous places, we had a better control over the boat which would otherwise, the instant it struck swift water, be carried into midstream by the action of the current. When the rope is tied higher, the tension caused by the united efforts of the crew in their endeavor to bring the boat back toward the shore tends only to hasten the overturning of the boat, entailing not only the loss of its contents, but generally that of the boat also. Thus improved, we had at all times complete control over our boats, and the worst sections of the river were passed without accident. This is where I decided that, hey, maybe I need to start putting markers actually on the map. I am researching the area between Quiet Lake and Finlayson Lake along Canole Road. That's the other border. And then the south, it probably will be bordered by this. So that could probably be the area for quite some time. When you think about the Yukon-Tanana terrain, you think about the mid-Cretaceous batholith, you think about the intrusions there, you think about the Tintina or Tintina Fault, which is apparently impacted by the Yakutat that is split from Silesia. So that's how it gets convoluted. I like to say Tintina, sounds nice, like Tata, if you watch the series. Before we move to this section, I wanted to have a tangent in between because this paper is quite long, but also this is a seminal paper, and because the person has actually described the way he sees the place. We are somewhere along Canole Road in 1976, but we are going back and researching that time. And we will also look at some research papers that talk about the geology of that area. Go down one related tangent. I like to call it a tributary in this case. Tangent would be me going off track, and a tributary would be like a small file along somewhere. Eventually, in some season, I definitely want to focus on the Richardson story because that is the whole source of inspiration. But that's going to be a separate season, which covers the whole Yukon, its wolves, its habitat, the Richardson Mountain, and everything else around it. But just to have a slight tributary going to the Richardson, Anticlinorium and the Bonnet Plume, the Richardson Trough, along with Eagle Plain and the folding and thrusting and whatever else is over there, along with the Yukon block that was protected. And that's the reason I want to have one tributary going up north when we look at the geology of that place. Also, we will look at the closing of an ocean, which is finally the ocean that I've decided we will close in the story. Initially, I was thinking of how to connect, because the closing of the Iapetus also has a connection to the Richardson Trough, but that's a longer story. There is an ocean right in between that has an entrapment story. At about the same time frame when we are talking about, it's in the Jurassic. So the closing of an ocean in the Jurassic, and it has an entrapment model, but there that model is being debated in a 2018 paper. I think the model was presented in the 1990s, and also in the late 1980s, I think, or 70s, when Templeman had done some research, and there was a passing reference to that ocean closing. It was called a different ocean at that time, so that's why when I watched the Baja BC series, this was called a different thing, and I was like, okay, they're two different oceans now. But then when I finally found one of Mitch Mahalanuk's papers where he calls out the name, and I'm like, oh, that's the same ocean they're referring to. So in the 1970s, he's referring to it as a different ocean, and then Mitch Mahalanuk calls it something else. It's essentially the same ocean, but I still need to read up those papers. But that ocean is around the Jurassic, and that story has some link to the Baja BC story. I'm not trying to connect to the Baja BC story. It's just that the Baja BC story gave me a good arc to connect to my Richardson story. And then the whole rabbit hole that I went down a rabbit hole because of the Yakutat. I read a paper where they talk about the 430-kilometer offset, 430 plus or minus 60-kilometer offset of the Tintina Fault, which brings Eagle Plains from Alaska right down south close to Finlayson Lake. And they show how the lines connect. And they found, like when they actually studied those areas, that corroborated the hypothesis about the dextral slip of the Tintina at that time, and it being only a maximum 490, so because it's plus or minus 60, so 490 kilometer slip, and that is a Tintina Fault. And that was my area because I was studying the Yukon Tanana terrain and going back in time in 1976, looking at that Templeton-Kluwet-Reed paper again, where I spoke about the whole region of the Quiet Lake, Batholith, the Finlayson Lake, the Pelly Mountain. That episode led me to look at more papers. That's when I landed on that 1974 or 1979, I can't remember, but it's a 1970s, I don't think it's an 80s paper, it's a 1970s paper where he makes a reference to that ocean. But the issue that took me down a rabbit hole and brought me back again to Baja BC is the Yakutat. Apparently, the Yakutat docking has an influence on the Tintina Fault, and the timeline is about the same, and which is why I was like, oh damn, now I have to go look at the Yakutat story. I wanted to just stay along the Yukon Tanana terrain, and that's when I went down that rabbit hole and then ended up reading about Celestia with the Yakutat, and the Celestia story was one story. Then when the Celestia docked, I think 50 million years ago when she docked, the Yakutat had its own story. And then that story, unfortunately, in my case, because I'm trying to reduce the rabbit holes. But wow, this is an interesting story anyway, because it has so many tributaries. But then that story got connected to the Tintina Fault, or the Tintina Fault, like I like to say, Tintin. And that's the reason I had to go connect the two stories and read up more about the Yakutat. And something that I stumbled upon that was just by fluke, because I was reading the Yakutat story and then I ended up understanding the formation of the St. Elias Mountain. For me, it was just, okay, some mountain range. It wasn't something I was thinking about. Although Haines Junction is important in my whole story, but St. Elias wasn't so important. It was the Richardson Mountain, which was more important. But then I was like, okay, fine, I need to look at this. And Kluane was definitely important because of its wolf and raven story, which is definitely going to be addressed in another season when I talk about the Richardson Mountain and the wolves of the Yukon. That's like a full season. But just now to start the story and continue with our plot about why Susi Pethonin is here somewhere around the Quiet Lake Batholith. What is she doing along Canole Road? A fluke or a chance event of having to read about the St. Elias Mountain story. And also, interestingly, the connection of the St. Elias Mountain eruption and the Beringia ice-free route, which is not supposed to be covered now, because right now we are way back. We're looking at Triassic, Jurassic, maybe even earlier than that, because Professor Scamander asked me to look at the Peace River embayment. So we are also looking at Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, all of that, and Precambrian stories as well, because that's still connected to the Richardson. But we are not anywhere close to the Ice Age. But Wolves of the Yukon talks about Berentia, and that will be part of season two. It is a tangent in this case, not a tributary. But that tangent was something I needed to chop off immediately. And also then the whole 1904 eruption of Mount Edziza that erupted in 1904. So I want to see that link. This is more like less of a tangent, more of a context to this story. Like, why are we reading such a long letter? So let's get back to now the description of the Teslin Lake. From the mouth of White Swan River, which enters the lake at its southern extremity, the distance to the outlet of the lake, or Teslin River, is 80 miles, 80. In this stretch, there is at its southern end a narrow section, 8 miles long, with occasional shallow places. This river-like extension is soon followed by an expanse 2 miles in length and width, and terminating in a neck called Moose Narrows. The neck is pretty prominent, but I can't find it listed as Moose Narrows. Beyond the narrows, the lake is shallow for some distance, but its depth soon increases. Moose Narrows may be considered as the commencement of the lake proper. There is another shallow spot at the foot of the lake just before entering Teslin River. Between Moose Narrows and Narzetlin Bay, the country east of the lake is very much broken by hills extending a long way into the interior. They rise to an altitude of 1,700 feet above the level of the lake and slope gently towards the shore. In a few places, they end abruptly at the water's edge, forming cliffs in places, and at other points, high and precipitous clay escarpments. The country is thickly wooded. Of the many streams draining it and running into Teslin Lake, I will only mention, besides
Narzetlin,
the Williams River, as it is the next in importance. The current is so swift at its mouth that it forces its way for a considerable distance through the placid waters of the lake without mixing its turbid stream with the dark waters of the lake. The distance from the entrance of
Narzetlin Bay
to the outlet of the Teslin Lake is 30 miles, 30. Between these two points, the shore of the lake trends northwest and is very uniform. The shoreline at the entrance of the bay is formed of precipitous cliffs, which, however, soon give place to a sandy beach. Back of the beach is a strip of low and swampy country of varying width, which extends close to the foot of the neighboring range of mountains. Adjoining this strip of lowland, there is towards the north a series of terraces, low at first, but increasing gradually in altitude, and by the time the foot of the lake is almost reached their crest, looms up several hundred feet above its level. Two large creeks, which rise in the high range of the mountains, east of the lower half of the lake, are the only streams which enter the lake. On July 23rd, having completed my observations at the foot of the lake, I returned to the entrance of
Narzetlin Bay,
where I had been preceded by the rest of my party, and began its survey. The bay opens in a northeasterly direction, and its length to the delta of the river is 5.5 miles. Up to the 5th mile, its average width is not over 0.5 mile. Its southern shore then takes a sharp turn to the southeast, and it continues in that direction for 2.5 miles and forms with the delta of the
Narzetlin River,
which is its opposite shore, another but small bay, 3/4 mile at its widest part. In the southern extremity of the small bay, there are numerous islands. A small stream also enters it. The quantity of sediment scoured at high water from the banks of such a stream as the
Narzetlin River
is necessarily great, and is the cause of the extensive delta formed at its mouth. The land is low and subject each year to inundations, which occur in the month of June. A narrow fringe of willows grows along the edge of the banks of the river, but back of it, natural prairies cover the greatest part of the land, which at the time of the survey was partially dry and producing good hay. So it gets flooded in June, but this was a drought season, he said. Yeah, okay. Because I'm wondering, how did he get to see so many features if it gets inundated? I see no reason why this hay could not be utilized in the future to feed cattle on their way to the Yukon markets. I mention this because cattle were driven this year for the first time over the Teslin Lake Trail, and as the experiment has turned out well, it may reasonably be expected that the route will be used again for the same purpose, and should there happen to be any time a scarcity of feed along the trail, the cattle could be brought here. The animals could not only have rest, but recuperate as well before being forwarded to the market. This land would then become valuable, as it is situated at the head of the navigable waters of the Yukon. Now we move to the next section where he talks about the exploration of
Nazetlin River.
On our arrival, the smoke, which had been thickening every day, became so dense that it precluded all photographic work for the time being. The season being already so far advanced, I was loath to lose any time waiting for a more suitable condition of the atmosphere, and I decided, as the next best thing under the circumstances, to make a traverse of the river, and if later the atmosphere cleared up, to begin a triangulation of the country. Such an opportunity, however, did not present itself for several days afterwards, and by that time I had completed the survey of 80 miles of the river.
Nazetlin River
empties into
Nazetlin Bay
by three estuaries, the middle one being the principal. The southern one diverges from the main stream at a point 2 miles above the bay and flows toward the foothills which limit the valley to the south. On its way, it branches off into several channels which send their ramifications through the meadows mentioned above. The other branch, north of the main stream, though narrow, is deep. The current is slack, except at its bifurcation from the river proper, where it is quite swift. On July 30th, we entered the river by its middle branch. A short distance above its mouth, it is 200 feet wide, with a depth of 8 feet of water. The channel follows close along the northern bank, which, like the opposite bank, is low and thickly covered with willows. A large sandbar has formed along the southern bank and spread a considerable distance into the bay. It is strewn with a great number of trees which have been detached from the banks during the season of high water and become embedded in the sand. 2 miles above its mouth, the river, which now runs through a single channel, increases its width to 700 feet, with a depth of 10 feet of water, but 1.5 miles further, it suddenly contracts again. At this point, the channel is obstructed by sharp-pointed rocks, the remains of a rocky ledge through which the river has cut its channel. There is deep water close to the right bank. The river soon widens again, and a distance of 0.5 miles more brings us to a large tributary which enters the river from the right. Its width, a short distance above its confluence, is 100 feet between the banks, which are low and well-timbered. It has a swift current and at the time of survey had a depth of 8 feet of water. Its waters are bluish. The volume discharged by it into
Nazetlin River
is equal to about 1/3 of that of the main river. The valley of the stream is wide and opens towards the east. A large gravel bar, which has formed a short distance below the point where it receives this eastern tributary, had been staked as a mining claim. At the time of the survey, it was not being worked, but there was unmistakable signs of its having been at some period. Owing to the thick smoke, which at the time spread over the country and appeared to originate from fires raging in the valley of this tributary, I did not care to spend any time on its exploration, but continued the survey of the
Nazetlin River.
The striking change from the clear bluish water of
Nazetlin
to a turbid color brought about by the mixing of the waters of Muddy River with those of
Nazetlin River
is what led to the discovery of this tributary. Up to August 12th, the smoke had been an obstacle to any photographic work, but a strong wind blowing constantly from the north had cleared the atmosphere to a certain extent and permitted the taking of photographs. With this prospect in view, I established a main camp on the bank of
Nazetlin River
and left it in charge of the cook, while with the rest of the party I entered Muddy River. Near its mouth, the current is rapid, averaging probably 3 miles an hour. Its waters being very muddy are evidently in great part derived from melting snow. On August 13th, I camped at the mouth of the first tributary of this river from the southeast. While the men were preparing for the night, I went along this creek, and after following it for 4 miles, I was surprised to find that its size increased considerably. Its bed was both deeper and wilder than nearer its mouth. This continued for a few miles more, where the creek changed to a turbulent stream rushing by boulders and rocks, some of great size. The low and flat country here gives place to high hills timbered with pine, around which the creek meanders. Its water is of a dark brown color and is undoubtedly from swamps near the foot of the mountain range. The next day I continued the ascent of the Muddy River and passed two other large creeks, also rising from the southeast. I continued upstream all that day and part of the next day, when finding myself close to the foot of a group of mountains which occupies the point formed by the Muddy River and
Nazetlin,
I established my last camp. Just above our camp, its channel was blocked by great piles of driftwood. The valley is not more than 2 miles in width. While the country west of the stream is hilly and broken, that on the opposite side is low and marshy and considerably cut up by old channels, which in the early part of the summer carry away the surplus waters. Beyond these marshes, there are rough hills upon which timber has been killed by fire. They culminate in high mountains rising 3,000 feet above the river. Now we are coming closer to my area. From the top of these mountains, I obtained the first glimpse of the southern end of the Quiet Lake. Towards the west, there looms up a high and serrated range of mountains, a continuation of the range which separates the valley of
Nazetlin
from that of the Teslin River. The valley of Muddy River is connected with the depression in which Quiet Lake lies by a low pass just north of the mountains which I had occupied as the station. Although I remained on the summit of these mountains for 4 days, I could not take any photographs, but was compelled to make sketches of different sections of country which came into view, when by the sudden shifting of the wind the smoke was driven in another direction. I was, however, enabled to trace the course of the stream 8 miles beyond our camp, where it branches off into several streams heading from the mountains and is fed by the melting snow which caps the mountains in that district late in the summer. On the fifth day, seeing that no better results could be obtained by remaining there any longer, we retraced our steps towards the camp, very much disgusted with the poor success which resulted from this, our first attempt in the mountains this season. The mountains to the east of the
Nazetlin River
do not form a continuous range, but are in groups separated from one another by deep and sometimes very wide valleys whose general trend is east and west. Near the mouth of the river, there are better called hills, and though these increase in altitude as we ascend the river, their highest summits never reach over 4,000 feet above the valley. In each of the valleys, there flows a tributary of
Nazetlin.
From the summits of some mountains which I had to climb in the vicinity, I could distinguish through the smoke the reflection of large sheets of water. These are located in the plains east of the mountains, bounding the valley of
Nazetlin
to the east. These lakes are the headwaters of the numerous small eastern tributaries of the river. On August 21st, we broke camp and started down the Muddy River. The absence of the sun had arrested the melting of the snow in the mountains, and consequently the volume of water in the river had been considerably reduced. Though we had frequently to drag our boats over shallow bars, we managed to reach our main camp that night. The next day, I continued the traverse of the
Nazetlin River.
Its direction for the next 40 miles is near north. It now meanders between high benches whose crests are within a mile of each other. From the top of these benches, terraces extend to the foot of the mountains. At the 14th mile, 1-4, on this stretch, we come to Carry Portage, leading to Quiet Lake. And I'm not going to Quiet Lake because it's quite along the Canole Road. That road is not maintained. So I don't want to take the chance, at least this time. Maybe some other time we'll go back. Here, I left a man in charge of our stores, and with the rest of the party, I proceeded up the river. There is also another portage of the same lake about 3 miles up. But the first one mentioned is preferable, being considerably shorter and running across a more even country. Besides, there are two lakes on it, one of which is a mile in length. This stretch of water is convenient to portage boats from
Nausetland River
to Quiet Lake. Above the last portage, the stream is very tortuous and impeded by a succession of rapids, which, however, must be greatly improved at high waters. These rapids are 2.5 miles long. 1.5 miles above them, a small river enters
Nausetland
from the east. Its right bank near its confluence is very high and precipitous. From the rapids, there is a broad and straight expanse of river 3 miles in length with low banks wooded to the water's edge. The current for a long distance is almost imperceptible. The bed of river is filled with quicksand, which rendered it dangerous to land at many places. Beyond this expansion, the river resumes its usual appearance. Swift current, high cut banks, especially on the right bank, and tortuous course. These characteristics continue up to its confluence with the Rose River, its principal tributary from the north. There are other streams heading from the same direction, but of less importance. Its valley was explored and the country, which it drains, will be described later. It rises from some lakes at the summit of the range of mountains which divide the Pelly River Basin from that of the
Nausetland.
From the mouth of the Rose River, the valley changes its northerly direction and stretches away almost due east, a distance of 8 miles. Beyond this, it inclines towards the northeast and has cut through a high range of mountains which bounds the valley towards the east and whose snow-covered tops could be seen glittering in the sun now that the smoke has partially disappeared. How much smoke are we talking about, man? He says his visibility is completely disturbed. So here a branch valley opens towards the southeast and leads to a mountainous district. Beyond that point, the chains of mountains on both sides of the river converge towards each other, and at 2.5 miles further upstream are so close to each other that they confine the river in a narrow, deep gorge whose sides are at some points formed by precipitous cliffs, at other points by high escarpments of sand and gravel into which large boulders are embedded. These, under the joint action of rain and frost, which disintegrate the softer material in which they are embedded, are precipitated into the bed of the narrow stream and cause obstructions, which are a serious drawback to anything but light boats. There are no large islands in this section of the river. The gorge is 6.5 miles long. Above the rapids, the valley widens again. There are numerous islands, and the bed of river, being free from boulders, becomes again navigable for boats, thus rendering access possible to the large lakes from which it rises. I now discovered that there would be more exploratory work to do here than I had anticipated, and if I kept the whole party with me, that our supplies would not last us long enough to satisfactorily complete it. I therefore sent back two of my men with instructions to transfer our stores and outfit from
Nausetland River
by the carry portage to Quiet Lake. In the meantime, accompanied by one man, I went on with the exploration. 4 miles above the head of the rapids mentioned, a second tributary, McConnell River, enters
Nausetland
from the north. Up to this point, the general trend of the valley is to the northeast. It now turns in a southeastern direction for a distance of 18 miles, 1/8. From the top of a mountain north of the river, which overlooks extensive plains spreading towards the east, there appears to be a low country dotted with lakes of all sizes and intersected by numerous connecting streams, which ultimately find their way towards
Nausetland.
From the same point of vantage, the eye rests on the mighty mass of a well-defined range of mountains which extends to the north. This range is separated from my station by a narrow pass lying at its base. A fine lake at the highest point of the pass is the source of the stream, which meanders along the foot of the mountain, which I had chosen for an observation point, and after receiving another large creek, the outlet of a good-sized lake, enters the plains and finally empties into
Nausetland River.
The distance from the confluence of the Rose River with the main river to the point with
Nausetland
issues from the lake is 18 miles, 1/8. The average width of the river throughout this section of the country is rather less than in the previous section. The islands are not so numerous and occur singly, not in groups, as is the case in the lower reach. The current is very swift, there being an average fall of 27 feet to the mile. Landslides have occurred wherever the current sweeps by the hill. Both sides of the valley are timbered from the water's edge to an altitude of 2,000 feet on the slope of the mountains. Having located the eastern sources and completed my photographic survey of the adjacent country, I now turned my attention to the exploration of some of its chief tributaries from the north. On September 7th, I returned to the mouth of the McConnell River, which I ascended for several miles. The next day, I occupied a prominent peak to the east of the river. Its altitude is 3,270 feet above the valley. It is one of the points in the chain of triangles covering this section of the country. The scenery of the region is very striking. Looking back over the river, it is seen that it may be divided into two principal divisions. The lower reach is 100 miles long and, with its sinuosities, occupies a wide valley. Forests of spruce cover the greater part of the bottomlands and terraces, and the slopes of the mountains are also clad with trees to an altitude of 2,000 feet above the valley. The strips of lowlands between the river and the foot of the mountains are often several miles wide. Along their foot, we noticed lakes or ponds, which act as reservoirs for surplus water which rushes down these mountains in the early part of the summer. There are numerous gravel bars on the river, some extend from the banks of the stream, while at other places, where its width is great, they have been deposited in the center of the stream. The second division of the river, or its upper reach, embraces not only its main eastern branch, but includes as well all its tributaries. These streams run in close proximity to each other through nearly parallel valleys and by numerous ramifications reach to the heart of the mountains which separate the basin of
Nazetlin
from that of the Pelly. The appearance of the country to the north is remarkably grand and imposing. We are here confronted by bold and serrated high ranges of mountains which stretch to the extreme limit of our horizon. These are clefts at intervals by defiles which converge towards the principal valleys leading to that of
Nazetlin.
The general trend of these valleys is nearly in a northeast direction. As may be expected, the streams which drain this district are nothing more than torrents, and in high water their ascent is attended with the greatest exertion and risk. After the freshets have subsided, they are too shallow for use of boats. On September 11th, I descended
Nazetlin River
as far as the mouth of the Rose River. The next morning, I began the ascent of that stream, which is 1.5 chains wide at the mouth with a depth of 2 feet of water, and for 1.5 miles from its mouth is nearly straight. This swift stream follows the foot of wooded hills, which separate its valley from the depression occupied by Quiet Lake. The hills, however, recede towards the west, while the river continues its tortuous course in a northwesterly direction. The river is frequently blocked by trees which have been detached from the banks and accumulated in a narrow part of the river, thus backing up the water, which spreads over the banks and forces it to cut new channels through the bottomlands. On the opposite side of the river, the bottomland begins at
Nazetlin
and stretches towards the north, where it is bounded by a sandy ridge, a projection of the eastern range of the mountains. This strip of land extends to the foot of the mountains on the east and is generally boggy. The river, after receiving a tributary from the west, skirts the extremity of a ridge, which it afterwards closely follows for miles. We had now reached a section of the river which is narrow and full of boulders and was difficult to ascend. We were obliged to drag our boats through it, the water being swift, 3 feet deep and icy cold. Our progress was so slow that I decided to abandon the boats for the time being and to continue the exploration on foot. Where did we keep the boats? Taking with us the instruments and supplies for a few days, we proceeded by the western side of the valley, which seemed to promise the best traveling. Where we left our boats, the stream divides into 3 channels formed by 2 islands timbered with spruce. 1 mile above the islands, there is a gorge formed by spurs from the high ranges of mountains which rise on each side of the river. Above the gorge, a turbulent stream enters the river from the east, after which the valley widens again and the velocity of the current is greatly reduced. In some sections, it is less than 2 miles an hour. A cursory examination of the country ahead of us was made from the top of a hill rising 300 feet above the river. It showed that the western side of the valley was the least broken and would afford the best route for our exploration. Beyond the gorge, our path led at times through forests and over sandy ridges in order to avoid marshy lakes caused by the overflow of the river during the freshets. At other times, it crossed prairies and stretches of brushy lands on the points formed by the bends of the river. As we moved up the valley, the mountains to our left became very rugged. Bold bluffs several hundred feet high face the river, while further inland they break into sharp peaks rising to a great altitude. The mountains east of the river, on the other hand, slope gently towards the river. Their slopes are still, to a certain extent, forest-clad, but near the river all the timber has been killed by fire and the trees are now thickly strewn over the ground. After crossing several creeks, we came to a point where the main valley breaks into two smaller ones. The one to the right-hand side continues in a northerly direction and is the valley of the Rose River, while the other one is from the northwest and contains a large tributary. The distance between the mouth of the river and Forks is 20 miles, 20. I established my last camp on this river near the mouth of a large creek which comes from the east and enters the river at 2.5 miles above the Forks. I had now proceeded far enough inland to gain a complete knowledge of the sources of the stream, provided I could succeed in climbing some of the high neighboring peaks which tower above the valley. From our camp, the valley of the Rose River lies between two high ranges of mountains. The valley itself is probably more than 3,000 feet above the level of the sea. During our stay in this district, heavy rains fell continuously and hardly a day passed without severe hailstorms. We now noticed with apprehension that the snow line on the mountains was getting lower after each storm, and that very soon the valley itself would be covered with snow. The leaves were now lying thickly over the frozen ground, a sure sign that the winter season with its many discomforts was fast approaching. On September 7th, after a very laborious climb of 7 hours, I reached the top of a peak forming the southern extremity of the range of mountains rising between both streams, but discovered that the view to the north, which I especially wanted to photograph, was intercepted by a row of higher peaks, which, however, owing to their present great distance, could not be reached the same day. I, however, did considerable work from the station now occupied, and the next day by daylight I was on my way to those peaks, from whose tops I expected to photograph the headwaters of the Rose River. The day proved to be a very bright one, though cold. By noon we had attained the highest peak, 8,700 feet above the level of the sea. The scenery is equal to, if not grander than, anything I have seen in the Rocky Mountains. At our feet lay the river, like a silver ribbon, winding its way in a maze of loops. From its banks spread a forest of conifers, whose dark foliage, broken in spots by the golden-hued foliage of poplar and birch, contrasted strikingly with the now snow-covered slopes of the precipitous sides of the mountains. Just north of us, the deep blue of the lakes from which the river issues added to the grandeur of the landscape. Beyond the lakes, I could distinguish a transversal valley through which probably the waters take their course towards the Pelly River. We were now in the heart of the mountains, limiting the basin of the Pelly River to the south. The erosion and inundation of these mountains are peculiar. The ridges are sharp and the gorges deep with very precipitous sides. The work was successfully completed from the station in that region. Night had set in long before we reached the camp. The next morning we began our return journey, and 2 days later we arrived at the place where we had abandoned our boats. Here I observed another peak. It was on its top that I noticed an abnormal local variation of the needle, amounting to 60 degrees east of the meridian. From this peak, I could see the Quiet Lake, 8 miles due south, but only its southern half, as the other part was cut off from my view by the hills which rise along the northern shore. North of these hills, the country is low, swampy, and full of small lakes, some of which drain into the first lake, whilst the eastern one runs into the Rose River. On September 24th, we again reached the Carrie Portage. Having been 20 days exploring all the sources of
Nazetlin,
Besides making the ascent of 7 peaks, distributed at intervals of several miles and chosen in such localities as would provide the greatest amount of information. Next, we have general remarks.
Now, Zetland River
is navigable for a distance of 50 miles, 50, in which its current is not over 3 miles an hour. Spruce of large size was frequently noticed along both banks of the river, but did not appear to extend to any great distance from the river. Besides spruce, poplar, and cottonwood, which grow on the bottom lands, pine is found on the top of the benches, whilst birch and balsam fir prevail on the slopes of the mountains. Raspberries, blueberries, high bush cranberries, and currants of large size and excellent flavor are to be had everywhere. The animals of the forest are found in abundance and are by no means shy. Moose are very numerous, and in the fall of the year, they leave the uplands and resort to the lower valleys for protection from the wintry winds and in search of better feeding grounds. They are by this time of the year in prime condition. Of the fur-bearing animals, I may mention the beaver, whose numerous tracks, strewn with freshly cut willow and poplar twigs, leave unmistakable signs of their presence and activity. They do not attempt to dam the stream, but seem to prefer locating their lodges in the high-cut banks where along the base there is a great depth of water, and in almost every loop of the river there are such spots. In traveling over this district, I came across only one beaver dam, which these industrious animals had thrown across a small stream draining the lowlands west of the Rose River. Though no bears were seen, the bars and banks of the river were covered with their footprints. I never traveled through any district which showed them in such numbers as in the one adjoining
Nazetland River.
The mountain goat inhabits the mountains and frequents the wildest and most inaccessible sections. The ptarmigan was the only bird we saw in these altitudes. The waters of
Nazetland River
and Teslin Lake abound in fish, but to take full advantage of this, one must be provided with a fishing net. Next section is on page 15, exploration of Big Salmon Rivers. The region drained by Big Salmon River and its numerous tributaries may be divided into two sections, each one having distinctive features of its own. A line drawn in the direction of the valley of the South Branch and produced across that of Big Salmon River in a northerly direction would fairly indicate where the change in the topography of the country occurs. To the east of this line are massive mountains crowned with high, rugged, and fantastically shaped peaks, frequently difficult of access as we found to our cost on several occasions. The slopes of these mountains are generally devoid of vegetation and are furrowed by deep gorges and ravines leading to valleys, of which there are several both north and south of the river. The snow, which never entirely disappears from their summits, acts under the rays of the sun as a feeder to the numerous tributaries of the Big Salmon River. The mountains north of the river attain their greatest elevation in a range which has diverted the general course of the river between the first and the second bends. Farther west, they, however, change to more regular outlines and lose the forbidding aspect which they had. The same remark applies to the range south of the river. And though their denuded and rocky frontal still continues to flank the valley for several miles below the second bend, they eventually disappear and are replaced by low and timbered hills, which bound the eastern side of the valley of the South Branch, while those on the north side of the Big Salmon River slope down to the level of extensive plains which spread westerly, and beyond which can be seen the crest of some low hills sparsely timbered on top, and with grassy slopes facing both the Big Salmon River and the plains. Beyond the South Branch, these hills and ridges are in groups on both sides of the valley and without any well-defined direction. In some places, they approach the river, but only for short distances. Such is the character of the country until the South Branch of the Big Salmon River is reached. From this point, the river flows through a terraced country. Both banks are formed by high and steep escarpments of gravel mixed with fine yellow sand. These escarpments, whose crests are at first less than half a mile apart, gradually recede from each other. The width of the valley is thus constantly increasing the farther down we go, and by the time its confluence with the Lewis is reached, its terraces have merged into those along the latter river. These terraces were at one time timbered with poplar and pine, as indicated by the numerous pieces of decayed timber lying on the ground. On my arrival at the Carey Portage, after completing the exploration of
Nazetland River,
I set to work to determine its position by an observation for latitude. I then surveyed the trail across the portage from the right bank of
Nazetland
to the southern extremity of the Quiet Lake and found it to be nearly 4 miles long. The path at first follows for some distance the southern side of a small stream, which at the time was dry. Then by a gentle ascent, it leads to a terrace which holds a lake, 3/4 of a mile long and 260 feet above the level of the river. The distance between the right bank of the river and the eastern end of the lake is 1.5 miles. Now, 1/2 mile beyond this lake is a second lake, less than 1/2 mile across. I think that's the Sandy Lake. The lake close to the Quiet Lake, north of it, is the Sandy Lake. So the distance between the right bank of the river and the eastern end of the lake is 1.5 mile. 1/2 mile beyond this Quiet Lake is a second lake, less than 1/2 mile across, and then a pond which is just north of the path and close to the foot of the high cliffs. We had now reached the highest point on the trail, 370 feet above the valley of
Nazetland.
From this point, the ground slopes a distance of 1 1/3 miles towards the south end of the Quiet Lake where the portage ends. With the exception of a short stretch between the river and the first lake where the soil is dry and firm, the trail passes over damp ground thickly covered with moss and some trailing willows with scattered scrubby black spruce. Owing to the ponds along it, the labor involved in moving boats and heavy supplies across this portage is greatly diminished. It is therefore much more frequented than the 1 3 miles farther north. We were now in the last week of September, and there were many indications of the fast approach of winter. The snow line, which had reached to within 600 feet of the valley, reminded us that we must not delay much longer. We had yet to descend a stream, which by a comparison of the difference of level between its source and its mouth, must necessarily be swift, and at this season of the year, shallow and full of rapids. The mountains from which my observations were to be made were very high and rugged, and the difficulty and labor in ascending them would be greatly augmented by the deep snow, which kept increasing after every storm. He mentioned hail coming down almost every day. On September 25th, we left our camp at the eastern extremity of the Carey Portage and sailed 10 miles northward on Quiet Lake and camped on the eastern shore. In the afternoon, we ascended the only hill there is on the east side of the lake. About midway along its length, it reaches an altitude of 2,045 feet above the level of the lake. This station, the first established in the basin of the Big Salmon River, was connected with our triangulation points on
Nazetland River.
The next day, we moved along the lake a farther distance of 5 miles, and in the afternoon occupied another mountain, but this time on the west side of the lake. The photographs taken from this station covered the western extremity of the lake, which had been invisible from the station occupied the previous day. Quiet Lake is a sheet of water 15.5 miles long by 3/4 of a mile at its widest part, and with its outlet, the Big Salmon River, an important tributary of the Lewis, occupies a valley which conforms to the northwest bearing of the valleys of two important neighboring tributaries of the same river, the valley of the Pelly River to the north and that of Teslin River to the south. Quiet Lake lies west of
Nazetland River,
and for 2/3 of its distance stretches in a northerly direction. It then curves to the northwest, which in a distance of 35 miles is the general direction of the big valley of the Big Salmon River. The level of the lake is 130 feet above that of
Nazetland River.
Its eastern shore is rocky with forests of conifers to the water's edge. A small stream which rises in the pass connecting the valley of Muddy Creek with that of Quiet Lake empties into the lake near its southern extremity. Beside this one, there are several others on the west side of the lake which rise in a massive range of mountains whose summits are amongst the highest of this region. Where these streams discharge, there are long narrow points stretching out into the lake, formed by the gravel and silt which have been carried down by the streams. On the east side of the lake, the strip of hilly country which lies between it and the
Nazetland River
is too narrow to admit of any important stream. The Big Salmon River issues from the western extremity of Quiet Lake. To the northwest of the lake, there are two other lakes. The first one is at a distance of 1.5 miles from Quiet Lake and is 1.5 miles long. It may be considered an expansion of the river, which on leaving it resumes its course in a northerly direction, a farther distance of 3 miles, to a second lake stretching in a northwest direction, whose greatest length is 5 miles, with a width of a little over 0.5 mile at its broadest part. The position of the longest axis of this lake is therefore lying nearly across the valley of the river, which enters its southern shore at about halfway between its ends and flows out of it near its western extremity. Two islands occur in the lake close to where the river enters. The eastern half of the lake is full of islands, none, however, of very large size and all timbered with spruce. A low tract, being the continuation of that in which the lake lies, leads towards the east of the valley of the Rose River. As the distance is short and the lakes numerous, it was doubtlessly used by the Indians as an easy way of communication between both valleys, for we found indications of the valley of the Rose River having been travelled extensively at some recent period. From the valley of the Rose River, the traveller could also reach that of
Nazetland River
by following an Indian trail, which enters a low pass through the south end of the range which divides both the streams. Once beyond the summit, the trail turns into the valley of Canyon Creek, which it follows as far as the canyon, where it crosses over to the left side of the stream and finally terminates at
Nazetland River.
The width of the Big Salmon River, where it issues from the last lake, is about 60 feet, 6-0, and is very shallow with a stony bottom. At the time of the exploration, this section of the river was a succession of rapids with a drop of 1 to 3 feet in short distances and separated by intervals of still water. At many places, the depth of water was less than 6 inches, and the canvas boats had to be partly unloaded before we could get them over the bars. Below the lake, the country on both sides of the river continues low and marshy, but it changes its aspect 3 miles farther on, where it receives its first tributary from the south. This stream flows through a wide and thickly wooded valley. Close to its headwaters, another stream rises, which flows in the opposite direction and finally enters the Big Salmon River at its second bend. After receiving this tributary, the river winds in innumerable and complicated bends from one side of the valley to the other. Its banks for some distance below the lake are low, but rise gradually from a few feet to escarpments reaching an altitude of 200 feet above the river. These cut banks are generally composed of gravel and sand, but cliffs are also noticed at different points where the river in its sinuosities strikes the foot of the mountain. The only remarkable change of direction which takes place in the course of the Big Salmon River occurs at a distance of nearly 60 miles from the last lake, 60. The river, which had been running northwest since its egress from that lake, is suddenly confronted in its course by bold mountains and is deflected at a sharp angle towards the southwest. This causes the first bend, where three mountain streams flowing through as many valleys converge and add waters to the river. You can see this on Google Maps. I think I've marked those 3 points. On the northern side of the valley, the mountains may be said to begin with Tower Peak, a lofty mountain which rises abruptly from the northern shore of the second lake and whose southern slope is so steep that no sign of vegetation is apparent on its surface. Its altitude is 3,140 feet above the lake. From a distance, it resembles a high ridge with a knife-edge crest. Its summit is capped by a cliff resembling a tower, which peculiarly led to its appellation of Tower Peak. It is one of the triangulation stations. Along both sides of the river, there are high mountains rising to an altitude of 4,500 feet above the valley. Within 10 miles of the first bend, these converge and thus contract the valley. The forest-clad sides often end abruptly at the river, which is reduced in width. The current at these places increases in velocity, while at the other places the channel is, owing to the vicinity of the mountains, full of boulders and required our utmost attention to be successfully navigated. Beyond this swift section, which is not over 3 miles long, the river bed widens again, but its channel is frequently impeded by sandbars formed by the silt which is being continually washed from the high cut banks and deposited in its bed at places where the current is slack. At the first bend, the left bank of the river is formed by high gravel benches cut by deep ravines, while on the opposite shore the country is low, with some lakes which act as reservoirs for two large creeks following from the northwest in two nearly parallel valleys. 3 miles below the first bend, the river divides into two branches. The wider one flows along the foot of the mountains to the left of the valley. 2 miles and a half farther, the branches reunite, and the river continues to flow in one stream towards the southwest, a farther distance of 18 miles, 1/8. After receiving another stream from the southeast, it turns sharply to the right and resumes a northwesterly direction. This point is called the second bend. About halfway between the first and second bends, I decided to attempt to make the ascent of some of the mountains in the range west of the valley. I left camp at daylight on October 6th, or we've reached October 6th now, and after having, with some difficulty, crossed the river, which at this date was already covered with floating ice, accompanied by one man, I started for the mountains. After traveling over frozen marshes, we entered the foothills by the valley of a creek, which we followed for several hours. We soon found ourselves hedged in between two walls, and to avoid being altogether blocked, we left the bed of the creek and climbed on to a long ridge heavily timbered with spruce. The ridge led us to a pinnacle towering at least 800 feet above our heads and which seemed inaccessible from where we stood. After a good deal of trouble and by a very circuitous route, we at last stood on its highest point, only to discover that the view south of it was obstructed by a row of sharp peaks which must be climbed in order to complete the work. Our progress was greatly retarded, for at that altitude the snow was already several feet deep, and it was after 6 in the evening before we completed our work. The cold was intense, and the night was coming on fast, but it was out of the question to stop, so we kept traveling until 2 in the morning, when we reached the river opposite our camp. But as we could not make ourselves heard because of the roaring noise caused by the floating ice, we had to wait until 6 o'clock in the morning before the man in charge of our camp came to our relief. Immediately after breakfast, we started downstream, knowing full well that no time must now be lost. But we had not proceeded far before we found the river blocked by ice, which, spreading across a narrow section of the river with high banks on both sides, had filled up several feet high. The temperature had been unusually low for several days, and as a result, the river had been carrying considerable ice, mostly formed at the bottom of the stream. This blockade had backed up the water for quite a distance and raised its level several feet. As the water subsided, a mass of ice was left in such a crumbling state as to render it unsafe to travel over or to attempt to cut a way for the boats through it. In order to get beyond this, we decided that to portage the boats and outfit through the bush was the safest thing under the circumstances, though not perhaps a very expeditious one. Once past this obstacle, we found the river comparatively free of ice, and the survey of the river was resumed. Occasional stops were, however, made at certain points where the ascent of some prominent mountains was necessary in order to carry on the photographic work. 10 peaks were thus climbed in the basin of the Big Salmon River. Last peak, the last one occupied, is north of the valley of the river and rises near the western edge of the chain of mountains whose width measured 45 from east to west, and across which the Big Salmon River has cut its way. The slopes of these mountains are as a rule very abrupt. Their average altitude is 4,000 feet above the valley. For several miles, the valley of the river is flanked by rocky walls so steep as to be entirely devoid of vegetation. West of the last peak, the aspect of the country is considerably altered and marks the termination of the mountains. Those to the south of the river have not these sharp and ragged projections which give to the ones we had been climbing such a forbidding appearance and rendered their summits so difficult to reach. Their elevation is also greatly reduced, and the farther west we proceed, the more curvy form their outlines become. The last mountain, which forms the western extremity of the range south of the river, has numerous spurs and or ridges which radiate both towards the Salmon River and its south branch. Those facing the valley of Big Salmon River and abruptly at the water's edge, while the spurs which extend towards the south branch eventually break up into low hills before reaching it, are heavily covered with timber. On the opposite side of the river, the characteristics of the country are still more striking. The range of mountains comes suddenly to an end at last peak. From its foot, a plain spreads out in a northerly direction. Several lakes and what appear to be the high banks of an important stream could be distinctly seen through the breaks at several places in the forest. The plain is limited to the west by a high range of hills which terminates abruptly at the Big Salmon River and just opposite the mouth of the South Branch. The top of the hills at this point must be nearly 1,000 feet above the valley of the river, with grassy slopes facing the stream, while their tops are crowned with clumps of pine. Beyond the second bend, there is no stream of any importance for 24 miles when the South Branch is reached. This stream rises near the headwaters of Boswell River, a tributary of Teslin River. It's hard to find the Boswell River on the map, but it's southwest of the Quiet Lake Batholith. I searched for some mining records because that's another way to find these rivers if they don't show up on Google Map. Anyway, its valley is very wide, running north and south, and is bounded on the east by the last contreforts of the chain of mountains. While towards the west, low hills not over 2,000 feet high extend as far as the Lewis River. 30 miles farther, 30, the North Branch, the largest tributary of the Big Salmon, flows from the north. Terraces 140 feet high rise on both sides of the valley of the stream. The valley is fully 2 miles wide where it joins the main river. 6 miles above its mouth, the North Branch bifurcates. One branch is from the northeast and it takes rise on the western slope of the chain of mountains to which the last peak belongs. Half a mile above the confluence of the North Branch with the Big Salmon River, there is a rapid which is frequented during the summer by Indians who have established a salmon fishing station there. 1 mile and a half farther down, there is another rapid in a sharp bend of the river. From this point to the mouth of the Big Salmon River, the river flows through a terraced country where all the timber has been destroyed by fire. The river is very shallow. Below the North Branch, it increases considerably in width and contains numerous large islands. The confluence of the North Branch was reached on October 12th, so 6 days from the 6th when he left. And as I had some work to do in the vicinity, I pitched my camp. That's my dog Denver, if you can hear something in the background. He keeps walking. Now he's sneezing. The next day, the weather remaining unsettled, I sent most of my men down the river with the heaviest part of the outfit, and with one man I waited for a change in the weather which would allow me to complete my work. On the 14th, no change for the better being apparent, I concluded that it would be unsafe to remain any longer. We therefore prepared to start the following morning, that is on October 15th. During the night, the crushing of the ice coming down from both the mainstream and the North Branch was so deafening that it was impossible to sleep. Long before daybreak, we were up and getting ready to leave. A thick fog hung over the river and was so dense that we could barely distinguish the outlines of the opposite bank of the river. The trees were loaded down with thick ice, and everything had a decidedly wintry aspect. The canvas of our boats must have been rendered very brittle by the frost, for our boat had hardly been in the water 5 minutes and only half loaded when we noticed that it was fast filling with water. Upon pulling it ashore and unloading it, an examination showed that its bottom had been rent by ice, which was now fully 4 inches thick. The damage was repaired in 10 minutes, but to prevent a similar occurrence, an opening was cut for it in the fixed shore ice, which extended 20 feet from the bank, and the boat placed in it. The loading being completed, we waited for a space of water free from ice. When the boat was hove out into the seething stream and all haste made to reach the middle. We hardly left the shore when the boat stuck so fast in the slush and ice that with all our endeavors it was impossible to steer it. To make matters worse, a thick fog caused by a low temperature was continuously rising from the river. Thus enveloped in semi-darkness, we drifted helplessly with a moving mass of ice which besieged us from every side. 1 mile and a half below our camp, we encountered the first rapid. Owing to the condition of the river just described, there was no breaking of the water to indicate the location of rocks and boulders. Only the uneven, undulating surface of the floating ice as it raced down the stream, with a sudden rearing up of occasional big cakes of ice as they came into contact with the largest boulders. It was a time full of anxiety. The canvas boat unavoidably struck several rocks, but it sustained the shocks without injury, though we could feel its bottoms heaving up under our feet. It was owing to its elasticity that no holes were punched through it. As long as we were moving with the ice, I knew that no mishap could occur, except from the ice blockades. And after we had successfully passed over the first rapid, we felt confident that we could safely reach the Lewis River. We, however, kept a sharp lookout, and no delay having occurred, we calculated that by noon we had drifted at least 10 miles. By this time, the sun had dispersed the fog so that we could better judge what we might expect ahead, and our anxiety was consequently greatly relieved. From early morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we kept up the struggle, and although our position was far from being comfortable, we had no thought of stopping. The right bank of the river is here formed by high escarpments. We noticed that the open channel of the river was getting considerably narrower, and before we had time to investigate fully, we realized that we were being forcibly drawn by the current into a regular whirlpool, that our chances of making a landing were gone, and that we were being relentlessly carried to our doom by the stream, whose velocity kept increasing every minute. Barely 200 yards ahead of us, the river was completely blocked by an ice jam under which the water rushed. The channel had now dwindled to only a few yards in width, but the ice on each side was only slush, which would not bear any weight. I realized that only a very slim chance of escape remained to us, and this was to try and prevent the boat from drifting across the stream. In this we were successful, and it certainly saved us. With the timely assistance of some miners who were camped in the vicinity, the boat was unloaded and brought ashore. They informed me that the river was blocked with ice for a distance of 6 miles, which could only be overcome by making a portage. The next day, everything was carried across the country to open water, and the descent of the river resumed. By night, we arrived safely at the Big Salmon River post, where we were cordially received by Constable Drury of the Northwest Mounted Police. He informed us that there might possibly be another boat from Dawson, but as the season was far advanced, I thought it safer not to delay, but started at once up the river. 2 days later, the steamer Flora overtook us when within 8 miles of the Teslin River post. White Horse Rapid was reached 3 days later. A delay of few days occurred at the end of Miles Canyon before another steamer put in her appearance. This was the Gilbourne, a steel vessel which brought us safely to Lake Bennett. From this point, Skagway was reached in good time and Victoria on November 6th. A week later, I reported at Ottawa, where I have since been busy preparing, from the notes and photographs taken, a map of the country explored during the past season.
Oh, Canada, there are the s'est porté l'épée, il s'est porté la croix. Ton histoire est une épopée des plus brillants exploits. foyeze no dra protegera no foyeze no dra.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sartastic Beast and Where to Find Them. The intro and outro music is by Yaakov Goldman, courtesy of Free Music Archive.